that were changing the tenor of practice. They were changing the tenor of practice. Did you notice this change in the early 1950s? Was there an older group of attorneys, people, maybe people like Judge Roach and Grigsby, I don't know if you could put them in the same class, Manders, and then there's a new group of lawyers that were coming in, like Cremo and Talbot and Fitzgerald and yourself, and that sort of.
Well, let's see. I think they're the older established practitioners, and then with the expansion of population, you had more younger attorneys coming in. Gordon Hartley, Cliff Groh, John Rader, Roger Cremo. Let's see, there was a practitioner named Evander Cade Smith, did mostly a property and divorce. My recollection is that the first bar luncheons that I attended in Anchorage, there were only about 16 attorneys. Elmer Peterson, mm-hmm. Bailey Bell, Billy Sanders, but yes, I suspect that there were a younger group. And you see, I kind of stayed in the practice of law. I didn't go into real estate or banking or investments or anything, and so. Oh, a year or so ago, I can remember I was trying a case down in Cordova, and we got the jury, and they're cranking along, and your stomach hurts, and you're worried about the last group of mistakes that you made. And we went down from the courthouse down to the little cafe there to get a cup of coffee during the noon hour. Because you can't eat lunch, you know, because it's mental processes are slow enough as it is without eating during trial. And I ran into Cliff Groh. I hadn't seen him in years. Mm-hmm. And Cliff says to me, what are you doing here? And I said, oh, you know, I got a trial in the old courthouse, a lovely little old courthouse if you ever get down there. Mm-hmm. It's just beautiful. It still smells like the Arby spittoons, you know. So. And we're just trying a case, and he said, what are you doing here? Oh, because he wasn't in court, there's only one judge, and I know he's not. He said, oh, that's my motor sailor out there. I just stopped in to get some fuel, you know. And that's the group that I started out practicing with, yes.
Do they go into practice with a different philosophy?
No, I don't think so. They were just more astute than I was.
Aggressive? Was aggressive?
Oh, yes, they were very successful practitioners. Mm-hmm. I was told long ago that nobody makes money in the practice of law, mm-hmm. and it's probably true. You may make money in a spin-off or through associations. I rather suspect, Gordy Hartley went into, of course, banking. And Cliff, I guess, was basically real estate and investments. And John Rader, probably more or less the same thing. And I think of that because that originally was the firm Hartley, John Rader. Too many people who started out practicing at the same time as I did that are still practicing. Of course, as fine a trial attorney as ever got inside a courtroom, Judge Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. He's just a beautiful trial attorney. He just make you cry. And so, you know, he would have been anyway, he would prefer to be on the bench, so that's where he is. You know, at that time, the United States Attorney was J. Earl Cooper. And he employed Seaborn Buckaloo as an assistant. And he was prosecuting. You know, everything was done out of your hip pocket in those days. It wasn't too sophisticated. Of course, they were. Coop wasn't doing an awful lot of work, and Buckley was. And he was looking for an assistant, and I suggested to him that he try to get a hold of Jim Fitzgerald, because I had seen Jim down in Ketchikan, and he was beautiful. And he got, he got Dave Talbot, who was, he'd come out of Cornell and gone into an admiralty firm. Talbot was out of Cornell a year or two before I was, I guess maybe 3 years, I can't remember for sure. So Talbot prosecuted with him for a while, but he got, and then Judge Fitzgerald, I guess he could only come up on loan. Pat Gilmore didn't want to lose him. I can't remember. And then I know he went over with the city. Mm-hmm. And was city attorney over there for a considerable length of time before he went into first working for, I guess he worked for Bill Egan Trench to reorganize the Department of Public Safety, which was kind of a joke, you know. There's a theory in public administration that you, when you've got a overage and fouled up department, you hire the administrator, who is really the axe man, who comes in, he fires everybody in sight, and he chops out this, that, and the other thing, and he gets it all lined out, and he makes all the enemies, because even though so-and-so was a bum, he had a lot of friends. And when you fire him, now you've got a lot of enemies, you can't administer the department, it's a mess. So you send in the axe man, and what he does is pave the way for the successor that you always had in mind you were going to send over there. Mm-hmm. And so Fitzy was supposed to go in and chop out the deadwood. And then they were going to send in an administrator. But Fitzy, being what he is, when he got through straightening the thing out, they wanted to keep him. I don't guess he wanted to stay all that bad. But he did a beautiful job with him.
He was appointed one of the first Superior Court judges, though, wasn't he? So that was a job he had right before the judgeship.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes, he was working for Egan.
Well, you've got me off my track of these early, the change in the practice. People like Evander Smith, was he new or old?
He'd been here a bit longer, mm-hmm. Kind of specialized in real estate. He had two or three girls sitting over there just typing out real estate contracts. You know, everything then was typed out. Mm-hmm. And there was so much ahead. And he did divorces. That was, I think, about the substance of it. I don't know whatever happened to him. He went down to South America on a vacation, and I think somebody threw him in jail down there, and it went several years before he got out. Uh-huh. I think somebody got a letter from him saying he was in jail. That was, I guess, South American justice. But I don't know how much. The basic change in the practice is that cases aren't negotiated to settlement. The old philosophy in Juneau, and perhaps still prevalent in some areas, was that you argue, but you don't go to trial. Mm-hmm. They didn't enter into the litigation with the idea of going to trial. Mm-hmm. Trial was the last thing in anybody's mind. Nobody wanted to go to trial. You go to trial, my God, bad things happen to you, and people see that, you know, maybe after all, what you were saying wasn't so good. So perhaps the younger group were more prone to go crash it out in court. I don't say that's been the it's been a bad thing. And by and large, I rather suspect it's been a good thing. Though maybe the court system thinks that it's overburdened and so forth, and swamped litigation. And anything that promotes litigation is, or a resolution of the dispute in court at least, whether it's promoting litigation, is something that's frowned down by the court system, I rather suspect. But if you're trying to measure the end result, I'd rather have the end result be a determination by 12 people sitting in a box than I would say my concept of what I think should be done for my client or can be done when I'm arguing with somebody, well, let's say in the old days, Bill Arnold. The results of negotiated settlements between unequals was not necessarily a thing of beauty and a joy forever. There's a lot of ironing that goes on before a jury. And so I don't think that it's a bad thing to have litigation terminated in court. I think rather many people, the philosophy is that that's the failure that gets there. It should have been settled and so forth. Yes, it should have been settled. But the fact of the matter is that if both sides aren't reasonable, it's going to wind up in court. And it only takes one to be unreasonable. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I think probably the general administration of justice, at least in the civil system, is probably better known than it was in the past.
The court bar fight. Why do you think it came about? Not so much the details of it, but the personalities involved.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, what you mean by the court bar fight. There was, and I have very little, really, memory and connection with it. I recollect that maybe I was supposed to have more involvement in it than I recollect. It seemed to me that there was, the first that I knew that there was supposed to be a dispute going on, I was in private practice. And I was asked by Bill Nesbitt to write up a series, or to write up a set of bar rules for disciplinary function of the bar. And I got a hold of a couple of three sets from other jurisdictions. And the only suggestion that I had made was that there hadn't been a successful conclusion to any complaint in some length of time. It should be streamlined enough so that we could get there to the end of one of these things, yes, wrong, or. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went through, you know, and picked out a section from here that was shorter than this one, and that's why I did. Mm-hmm. I spent all of a good day on it. And I think I was handsomely paid, you know. Mm-hmm. I think those times we were charging $25 an hour. And probably somewhere there's the old building. I rather suspect that I was maybe paid $100 mm-hmm. for writing the bar rules. And I know they were circulated, and there was a great wailing and gnashing of teeth because they were only given, you know, 30 days to do this or that or something else rather than some other period of time. And I had certainly shortened down the periods of time wherever it said 30 in the other rules, I'd make 15 here. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, and I rather suspect it was as much personality as anything else. And shortly thereafter, there was supposed to be some kind of a bar fight. I know that the main object of the arguments that I heard were directed toward Bill Nesbitt wanting to discipline the bar. And Bill had a reputation of being a drinker, see, and they wanted him to go back to sucking on a bottle rather than worrying about reforming the bar. Mm-hmm. But that, I never did understand what the real fight was supposed to be about. The rules weren't adopted. They probably shouldn't have been. On the other hand, I don't think anything was adopted to take their place either. And but Harry Aaron was recalled, or didn't make re-election, and ran against himself. I rather suspect the bar always has claimed credit for that. I generally suspect that it was the result of his decision in connection with a school teacher that offended the education group, and they were pretty well organized, and they worked very, very hard. The bar always claimed.
What was that? What was the decision with the school?
Oh, let's see. It was like maybe one of the blue cases out of Surrey. That would be my guess.
One of the blue cases out mm-hmm. of Surrey?
There was a gentleman named Blue who was fired. And it went through a series of litigations about whether or not he was given a proper hearing, and that went up and back. And Don Burr started out on it, I think, mm-hmm. representing Surrey. Where did I get in it? I got in it somewhere. I can't remember. Maybe I reviewed a transcript or something. But I think probably the education lobby, they were just getting, the teachers' organization was just getting organized. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of a starting point for them. I always thought that they probably did more about it than anybody else. But I don't know if anybody in the Bar Association would agree to that.
The Bar was circulating letters to all its clients. Did you receive those letters?
I never did anything like that.
Yeah, trying to find a copy of it. They said that there was a master letter and they just sent that to all their clients.
I don't recollect that. Mm-hmm.
Were the other bars involved, Juneau and Fairbanks?
I know Fairbanks must have been involved because I can remember attending some kind of a convention or meeting at that particular time. I was practicing law with Harold Butcher. It was Butcher, Biz, and Atkinson. Mm-hmm. And Harold was very much involved. And you should interview him. Mm-hmm. If you haven't, you have, okay. Harold was very much involved. And I can remember somebody from Fairbanks, I don't remember who the attorney was, coming up to me and saying, I thought you were supposed to be a Nesbitt man. Yeah, which was a surprise to me. I didn't know that I was anybody's. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he was from Fairbanks, so I know that at least Fairbanks was involved. I rather suspect that Southeastern would be less involved because in many ways that's a different country when it comes to, or it was at that time anyway, when it came to bar affairs. This was, you know, Bill Nesbitt was from Anchorage, and that's just a bunch of Anchorage people who are having problems.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't want to have anything to do with it?
I don't recollect anybody from Southeastern having anything to do with it. I don't really recollect much about it anyway, but it seems to me that Southeastern didn't have too much to do with it. Maybe, you know, some of them. Maybe Mike Monocle. Mike might have. I don't know about Ziggy.
Mm-hmm. When were you in a partnership with Butcher and Atkinson?
When?
Mm-hmm.
We formed the partnership when I was just moving, getting ready to move my office books and library and stuff over to the place when the earthquake occurred, and I didn't have to take the books down from the shelves. All I had to do was pick them up and put them in the box. So whatever, if you can remember when that was.
64.
It would have been in the spring. That would be when we had formed the partnership. Something I was, in connection with a bar fight, I remember there was some kind of an argument. The basic philosophical problem, as I recollect the way it was presented, was that Bill Nesbitt wanted a justice in Fairbanks and one in Anchorage and one in Juneau and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I personally thought that it would be a heck of a lot better if we all sat down and talked to each other, because there was some evidence that we were getting opinions from three different courts.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than one. And I just personally thought, based on my own experience of arguing with other attorneys and formulating a net result in my own mind, that it would be better if they did all live in the same room. But that perhaps wasn't in accordance with political reality, and it hasn't really been realized these years later. But the bar employed a fine attorney by the name of Joe Ball from California. Joe was, of course, just an outstanding constitutional lawyer and very effective. I can remember going over in the library. Things are awful rough and ready, you know. And I volunteered some time. We went over and did some research on some questions that were presented in the case. And I can remember him citing the cases that I dug out from the library that afternoon with him. I can't really remember how that would have been presented in a court framework, but it was I can remember him coming up and participating, and old Bob Yandel, I think, was
how do you spell that?
Yandel? Y-A-N-D-E-L. Robert K. Yandel. He probably was as strong a personality as existed in those days. He lost a leg at Shadow Tiari.
At what?
That's a different generation.
But what was it? What?
He went over the top in World War I.
Oh.
And lost a leg in small arms fire in France.
Chateau?
Chateau Tiari.
Tiari.
That was one of our, one of the, I guess the bloodiest of the United States engagements. Anyway, he was good enough, so they took him back World War II with one leg in the Marine Corps. He's a tough man, really tough, really tough. And Bob knew Joe Ball. Bob knew everybody. And he taught Ball in coming up to represent the bar.
So he was practicing up here, Bob?
Well, yes.
Was he a territorial practitioner? Become at UI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he prosecuted and then went into private practice. Mainly he was a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
A fine old gentleman.
Yeah.
And Judge Fitzgerald would have been mentioning, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Joe Josephson, everybody knew Bob.
So he talked, he was one of the people who talked Ball into coming up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you did do some research. Did a lot of the attorneys just pitch in and work?
I don't think so.
No?
I don't know what the others did, but I can remember talking with Ball, and I don't know why he was talking with me. But anyway, we got together and he wanted to know what I thought about something or other, and we wound up going over to the library to do the research. There was something about an argument on the validity of a territorial statute.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old days, the basic setup of the territorial government had a provision in it for certain classes of litigation. They had to run through Congress. And there was a check there. Territorial legislature couldn't do just anything it so hard desired. The check was very seldom used and almost never referred to. And I know that Ball's office had apparently done some research and so had some people here and briefed him on what it was he was supposed to be doing, so forth. None of them had ever mentioned it. And it was a different point of departure on the validity of that particular statute. So that's my recollection as we went over and took a look at that, because back when I was in law school and I read the territorial statutes, I also read the Enabling Acts and the basic legislation. I was a government major as an undergrad, and so I was trying to get lined out on where the power would be ultimately.
What was it like working with Butcher, Harold Butcher? Was he part of the old school, the new school, or?
Oh, Harold is one of the old timers.
Mm-hmm.
Harold, of course, is he was more of an office practitioner than he was a trial attorney, although he was a good trial attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And we practiced for, well, until he went on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And the partnership was dissolved then. Maybe we ran a year or two, and then Atkinson set up his own firm, and Harlan Davis came over.
Mm-hmm.
That was Butcher, Biz, and Davis, until such time as Harold went on the bench, and then Harlan and I each set up separate practice. And I was in sole practice, so up until the time I was fortunate enough to have Roger come over and work together with us.
Why have you moved out here? Why did you move your practice?
I'm not sure why I moved here. I should have moved further.
Why?
I would prefer to live in the country in a rural setting than I would in the city. And many people here think you have to have an office next to the courtroom. In the old days, you know, all of the offices were within a block of the courtroom. You wouldn't think of anything else. Literally across the street. And boy, if somebody got 5 or 6 blocks away, they were out in the hinterland. That's not really necessary, depending on the kind of practice. Walk-in type of clientele, in my practice, just use up my time. And they're an interruption. And I don't want, you know, for many, many years, Martin Dale Hubbell comes around sometimes. We try to ask him, how can we get out of the book? We've got more stinking business than we want to do now. And we spend too much time evaluating cases to turn them down or refer them to somebody else. It's not a matter of having to have an office next to the courthouse. You have an office anywhere. As a trial attorney, if the trials in Fairbanks or Ketchikan or Funnel or Kodiak or Anchorage, it doesn't make any matter to me. You go wherever it is. You're not going to take your office with you anyway, so what difference does it make? It's an inconvenience to travel from here to Anchorage to argue a motion. I've driven it many times, so I know that I can make it in roughly 45, 50 minutes. And so many people think that, well, I should, there's nothing wrong. You see, you're not living out in the Tules if you're down in Anchorage living on the hillside, and it only takes you, 35 minutes to get. So it's not all that much difference. In the first place. In the second place, if you want to schedule a deposition in Anchorage, find Danny, I'll come in to the deposition. And I go in for depositions and motions and trials. And that's about it. If you want to schedule a deposition and then wait till I get there and cancel it, or schedule one today, one tomorrow, and one the next day, and spend 30 minutes on each one of them. There's a truism that I can demonstrate. As you see, I can schedule depositions too, and you'll find that it's just as far from Anchorage to here as it is from here to Anchorage. And there are relatively few people actually in trial practice and litigation in Anchorage, in civil litigation. And so that's something that everybody gets to understand.
Yeah. Has the practice, just the tenor of practice and everything else, been what you wanted it to be? You didn't want to practice in New York City. You came up to Alaska instead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
What aspect?
Well,
can you see
it? I'm not interested in commercial transactions, and so I would rather try cases involving fact situations with which I'm personally familiar or with which I understand. I like construction. Things with which I'm familiar.
Did you build your own house? Did you?
No, and yes. My wife and I designed the house, and then we had Ralph Alley go through and and make sure it wasn't going to fall down and do his thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hired a contractor. It was a client of mine, a friend of mine. He's still a friend, you see. And he built it, and we did some work on it from time to time as we went along. I'm not a carpenter either, but we do a little bit of everything. I was raised on a farm, mm-hmm. so we can do anything. There.
Do you do any farming out here?
Oh, we do a little gardening.
Gardening?
We cut a little hay.
A little?
Mm-hmm.
Animals? Do you have any?
I kind of stay away from much in the way of livestock, other than maybe have some chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, next month maybe I'll be trying a case somewhere for 2 or 3 weeks, and I don't mind. But they like to be fed and watered and bedded and cleaned out. And my wife didn't sign up.
To do that?
No.
Yes.
And Allison's still too small. He's coming now.
How old?
He's seven.
Seven? Mm-hmm.
Is there any, maybe I'm just fishing, the tenor of practice, has it changed since you've been here? Has the type of people you see practicing change, or
oh, I think probably you've got the people appearing in court and litigation are younger.
Mm-hmm.
The opponents are younger. And of course the amounts involved are much, much greater. Jury verdicts have increased tremendously. And the litigation costs have gone up terribly, which in my personal opinion is that it's promoted largely by the advent of discovery under the federal rules as applied. You discover a case and discover it and discover it and discover it. And then you go try and it's a different case anyway. But it's just another technique, and it's very, very expensive. Depositions are a very, very expensive method of finding facts. And, interrogatories are really a waste of time. So that, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that every case now has to be treated as an important case. It has to be prepared as though it's going to trial, because my golly, maybe you only get hit 1 out of 10 times, but when jury verdicts come in the range that they're coming in now, there isn't any such thing as a case that is without risk. You never find out whether or not your argument is with or without merit until the Supreme Court says it's without merit, you know. It's not comfortable until then. So, not too long ago, I participated in the trial, which resulted in the largest personal injury verdict in the history of the state, in which the jury awarded a young man who'd been injured in an industrial accident up on the North Slope $7,128,000, something like that, with prejudgment interest, cost and attorney's fees $10 million. I considered it to be a case of no liability. I refused to participate in probably 60-70% of the depositions that were taken in it. I couldn't imagine that it was going to result in a verdict like that. Um, So anyway, probably I should have gone back and attended all of those depositions and sat through the interminable histories of the witnesses and what high school they went to. But...
what did it change the verdict?
I don't think so. I represented a co-defendant, and my client was found not to be liable, but Exxon got hit. I don't think that my setting in the verdicts would have changed the fact that the jury was told several times, in the event they didn't already know it, that Exxon was the world's largest oil company. Sometimes you have those things happen. It's still a better system than anything else, but that was really a terrible display. But I could easily have been collected up in that too, you know. I felt that axe go by like that.
Are the juries different now? Are the people
yes.
who are listening?
Yes, see, your jury verdicts went up. There are a certain amount of politics involved in the rules of procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that went in with the proper disguise was the idea that people who are imposed upon to serve on juries shouldn't have their life so disrupted as to have to serve over a long period of time. And so we have a revolving jury system here in which very rarely, really, do you have a jury panel that has heard two or three civil cases. Very rarely do you have a jury panel that's heard one. It works the same way in criminal cases. The first time out of the box, the jury hears the terrible tears flowing and so forth, it's very impressive. And they respond accordingly, as anyone would. The second time, it's perhaps less impressive. The fourth or fifth time, they begin to look at the way things are rather than how the picture is being painted. And at least my personal opinion is that when we went to this new juror every time you show up, the jury verdicts started going up dramatically, and they have continued to do so. There are probably many more complicated social reasons, but I'll bet you anything that that's one of the procedural reasons. So you always have fresh jurors, and they haven't ever seen.
In the 50s, you had such a small population. Were your juries people you'd seen often and you know who you were talking to? And it was much easier to gauge how a jury was going to react.
Mm-hmm. And also, they were much less susceptible to emotional arguments.
Mm-hmm.
When they don't know the attorney, they don't know the client, they don't know anything about the fact situation except what's been spooned out in court. They're much more susceptible to these wide swings of emotional response. And if I can get a jury that's seen me in other cases and that I know something about them, then I'm much more comfortable. They know that they should try to help my client because I'm not good. I have much better luck with jurors than I've had before.
Mm-hmm. Stan McCutcheon, do you remember him from the 1950s?
Mm-hmm.
What was he like?
Of course, of the older practitioners, Stan was one of the most active, energetic dramatists as a trial attorney. And of course, the McCutcheon family had been here for a long time. McCutcheon and Nesbitt. Judge Buckley practiced with him initially before he went into the district attorney's office. I think Roger Cremo was there for a while. Cliff Grohl may have been there too. And I know Rader was, of course, because it was John Rader practiced several years. Stan was a politician. And he was in politics all the time.
Did it help him as a lawyer?
I don't know. That was what his interest was. I never figured that Stan was really interested in practicing law per se, in the classical sense, or being in the court day after day after day and getting your head pounded on. Stan knew that life was kind of short and you should enjoy it while you can. And he would rather have flown over to Sucker Lake and gone fishing.
Did you get over to Sucker Lake?
Have I ever? Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Go out with these guys fishing?
No, I don't think I ever went out with Stan. But yes, different members of the bar.
Is that the bar's lake? What's this?
Well, it's kind of.
About
well, it was a lake across the inlet where they had some cabin. Of course, they had camps around different places. I flew over there with Ben Kirkland, who had a relationship with McCutcheon. He may have practiced with him. Over there with Kirkland, go fishing late at night. Took off from Anchorage in the summertime, and it was still light. It's a drunk, it's hard to get in the airplane. And we landed over there, and he slept all the time we were there. I went fishing. Back in the airplane, came back,